Hello and welcome to Hot Pursuit, part of Ahwa's video and podcast series. Today we are again going to talk about the growing conflict in the southern Caucasus with the Nagorno-Karabakh as its epicenter. With me, Tom Duval, a top expert on the area and the region, especially on Nagorno-Karabakh, the writer of the book Black Garden. Welcome, Tom.
Good to see you, Evers.
Good to see you as well. Let's begin our tour d'horizon. I think we need to update many details since our latest conversation. First of all, I think the atrocities seem to be, hostilities seem to be enhancing across Armenia proper and Azerbaijan proper. And also the intensity of the bombing, mutual bombing, is now touching large chunks of the civilian population as well. What is happening, really?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to get a detailed picture, and there are foreign journalists on the ground on the Armenian side, but none on the Azerbaijani side, which raises some questions there.
There was a couple of reporters, one reporter in Gence,
right,
for France 24, but
right,
it was very sporadic and just on telling what it is, the destruction mainly. But as you say, you know, it is the situation, lack of reporters.
But from what we can piece together, yes, indeed, the conflict is widening. We've seen now several days of long-range weapons hitting the Karabakh main city, Stepanakert, reports of civilian casualties, use of drones there. So this is, I get the ongoing story, really, of, and of course, the Azerbaijani side talks about taking back occupied territories, and that's within international law. Well, certainly those territories belong to Azerbaijan within international law, but Karabakh, targeting civilians, is certainly contrary to international law, and we've seen that for several days now. Yesterday, as you mentioned, in Ganja, the Armenians launched, again, some long-range rockets. They said they were targeting the airport, but as we saw footage of a city street and people and casualties there. So it's intensifying. The emotions on either side are intensifying. The Armenians are saying this is a fight for our very existence. The Azerbaijanis are saying this is a fight for liberation of our lost lands. And again, a very weak international response. So not a good situation at all.
In terms of military strategy, how do we read into this widening of the conflict, in geographically speaking? Has Baku or Yerevan changed their strategies now by widening this?
Well, not really. I mean, I guess the point to make is the geography of this conflict means that in order to prevail, you have to be fighting in a number of positions. A lot of this is mountainous territory, which is very difficult to fight over, which also means that the use of these long-range artillery shells and so on and drones. But the other thing is obviously that the war of the 1990s was a rather localized war with low-tech weaponry, mainly between the Armenians of Karabakh and a rather disorganized Azerbaijani force. This is now a war between two states, two heavily armed states, particularly the Azerbaijani side, very, very heavily armed, lots and lots of Israeli, Russian, Turkish weapons in Azerbaijan. So there's a kind of military logic to this, that once you start this, you need to, in order to claim success, you need to widen it in order to get success. And of course, the unfortunate military logic is the other side then retaliates. This creates, and you know, this spins out of control until someone can stop it.
There was a balance of terror on as the conflict went on between two sides. Now, can we say one side has more superiority now that the some claim that Azerbaijani side have more sophisticated weaponry that put in usage?
Well, certainly in terms of weaponry, the Azerbaijani side has much more sophisticated weaponry. But the Armenians, as we saw yesterday in Ganja, also have some long-range missiles. They have some S-300 cruise missiles, which would be incredibly fearsome weapons. The Armenians also have the advantage of the mountainous terrain, which is, again, one reason why the Azerbaijani side is using these long weapons, because to throw young soldiers into battle is literally an uphill battle in a lot of these places. And of course, that raises the issue of these alleged Syrian mercenaries, which is maybe one reason that if they are there, and I think they are there, they were deployed to the ground, was again to avoid the Azerbaijani side using young soldiers of its own.
Many Western sources, Guardian topping that, reported about approximately 1,000 Syrian fighters, jihadists, mercenaries, whatever you want to call them, and there were more than 50 funerals of killed that Syrian fighters, etc. And it's no longer doesn't seem to be a secret that the involvement of the or exportation of these fighters from Libya or Syria is known now, and still we don't know with how much of an irritation to Moscow it is. But since our latest conversation, I'm sure you read more into the Turkey's role, mm-hmm. engagement, positioning, posturing. How should we read into this this involvement in the eighth day of the conflict?
Well, obviously it's very serious, and I think it doesn't need to be said, but maybe it does need to be said that, of course, for Armenia, Turkey is the big existential threat. That there's been peace with Turkey more or less since 1920, exactly a century ago. There's been no shooting war, and now suddenly Turkey comes in on the side of Azerbaijan, and for every Armenian, this is a real threat into their DNA. So that's, I think, one thing to be said. Even if the Turkish military involvement is indirect, and I mean it is direct. The Turkish involvement of the Turkish army is indirect. So it's a huge issue for the Armenians. Turkey seems to want to exploit an international vacuum where the Americans and Europeans are absent, where the Russians don't really know what to do. The Russians have been relying as a kind of managers of the equilibrium in this conflict, and now the equilibrium is broken. So Turkey and Azerbaijan are trying to kind of exploit this moment of indecision and weakness. They want to, at the very least, get some territories back and sort of remake the negotiation process to break the OSCE negotiation process and remake it again in their favor. That seems to be the strategy. But obviously, we don't see into the minds of the Turkish leadership what they see it for them. Are they poking the West? Are they doing this for domestic reasons? What is the strategy in Turkey? There can be many explanations for that.
Do we have any explanation as far?
Well, I was going to ask you, but I mean, clearly, obviously, it's a good factor for domestic politics. Mm. It plays well fighting against the West. This narrative. Treaty of Sèvres was exactly a century ago. It seems to be the Sèvres syndrome repeated. The question is, to what extent is this a long-term commitment? To what extent would Turkey be prepared to escalate? Because it also causes problems on other fronts, not least in NATO, which I'm sure, it's causing huge problems with other NATO allies. So it's not clear where Turkey is prepared to stop here. I'd be surprised if Turkey would be prepared to go all the way.
There is a puzzling point which sort of baffled us observers yesterday. Devlet Bahçeli, the political ally of President Erdogan, ultra-nationalist leader, ultra-nationalist party leader of the MHP, tweeted yesterday saying that it is of utter importance that Nakhchivan autonomous region is immediately joined Azerbaijan proper. Some observers interpreted as something obvious, something maybe he was being misled to write about. But some of us, including myself, interpret this as something of an encouragement for Azerbaijanis to carve a way between Azerbaijan proper to Nakhchivan from south of the Karabakh. And we know that there have been more than, you know, atrocities there as well. And there were also reports as of this morning that Jebrail was taken by Azerbaijani forces. Do you see any kind of movement being more exposed there in that part?
Well, I mean,
alongside the Iranian border?
Well, it has to be said, that would be extremely dangerous escalation because this would involve seizing territory of Armenia in between Nakhchivan and Azerbaijan. It would also enrage Iran, which is the direct neighbor. This is the Armenian-Iran border, which is absolutely vital to both countries.
In what way? In what way it is vital? For our viewers, I think it should be important to know.
Armenia has four borders, one with Azerbaijan, one with Turkey. Obviously, both of those are closed. One with Georgia, which is open, which is an important trading border. But obviously, the Georgians have very strict restrictions on what they allow in. So we're getting reports of some military equipment coming through Iran. But also, this is Armenia's border to the south. It's border to Iran and to the south. So were it to lose that, it would be very important. This is a north-south axis between Armenia and Iran, which neither side wants to lose. If the territory of Armenia is attacked, then Russia has a military treaty obligation to defend Armenia. Russia's been trying to stay out of this, but it would have no option if there would be an attack on of that nature. Having said all that, I don't think this is realistic. This is mountainous territory. It's very well defended, and the Azerbaijanis are still a long way from that border. It's still, you know, it's Jebrail is the region in between. You've got two other regions, Zangalan and Kubatli, in between, right? Jebrail and Armenia.
And there are skirmishes there as well.
Yes, but I think the chances of the Azerbaijani
side
taking all the territory up to the Armenian border are much smaller.
Okay, I have two more questions, and I think these are also as important. One is, of course, the U.S. absence and Russian absence. You were quoted, I think, in one of the articles that I think it was in Guardian, that, you know, Trump has never been interested in Azerbaijan. If anything, it would be about building a Trump Tower. So the U.S. is absent. It's apparent. And Russia is absent. Why is that? It's been 8 days, and the assessment was that Russians would enter the stage sooner, but it doesn't. What is happening?
So on the Americans first. So the Americans, you know, they are one of the three mediators. They've had a traditional interest in this conflict, but again, that has declined under Trump. And of course, many people in the State Department know this conflict well. At that level, I think there is an attempt to engage, but at the senior level in the White House, the Secretary of State level, there just seems to be no interest in engaging with this conflict. There seems to be no appetite. What is that connected with? A general disengagement, or with the election, or with both? It's hard to say. With the Russians. The Russians is more of an enigma, but I've been saying for years that have far fewer levers of influence in this region than they like to say they have. And I think that thesis is now proved to be correct. The Russians have troops on the ground in Armenia, but not in Karabakh or in Azerbaijan.
Have Russian commanders in the Azerbaijani headquarters. Military headquarters or not?
No. There are no Russia. There's a Caspian Sea flotilla, but that's a long way away. Mm-hmm. You know, if Russia wants to, you know, intervene directly in Azerbaijan, that would be incredibly dangerous. They would lose the relationship with an important neighbor. So they're trying to kind of come up with a strategy. They're trying to regain the equilibrium. But they've certainly losing enormous reputation in Armenia by their attitude, and the Russians will try to see if this both sides kind of grind to a halt, and there's as a moment of where the military action stops by its own lack of momentum, as it were, and then they would possibly try to intervene. But at that point, I'm not sure either side trusts them, and I think Russia, the Russian kind of strategic calculus that you could insert Russian peacekeepers in there, looks even more difficult when both neither side really wants them on the ground, and they lost their authority. So there are some things that Russia can do, but it's also distracted in Ukraine and in Belarus. So I don't think there's a big Russian strategy here. I think they're still trying to work out what to do.
One observation was that countering the Russian aloofness was that Russia was waiting, calculating, premeditatively waiting to come in to the stage with the what's called a Lavrov plan. But it doesn't seem to be happening, is it?
No, I mean, there's also analysis that Russia was wanted Pashinyan to suffer a bit so that he would
Do you
swear.
agree with that?
Well, I mean, possibly, but then swear complete obedience to Russia. But then the problem, Russia doesn't really have an Armenian problem. Armenia is its ally anyway. It has an Azerbaijan problem. So for Azerbaijan to do well decreases Russia's influence in the region. So the better Azerbaijan does in this conflict, the less influence Russia has. So as Russia really needs to have a strategy to deal with Azerbaijan, not with Armenia.
And that is being, of course, observed and used by Turkey.
Exactly.
Also, shed light, please, if you will, on the energy dimension of this. There were reports in July that Armenia changed some of its bordering positions vis-à-vis the energy line between Azerbaijan, I think through Georgia. Does it have any importance in this conflict, in this context?
Well, I mean, these are the threats that the Armenians make from time to time, that we could target the Baku-Ceyhan pipeline or some pumping stations with our long-range missiles, or indeed the Mingaçu reservoir, which was being talked about yesterday. That would be another way of devastating Azerbaijan. But I think they know that that's to do that is to kind of unleash total war, and some of this horrific heavy weaponry on the Azerbaijani side. So I think some maybe instinct of self-preservation is drawing them back, hopefully. But it's every day that goes on, the more we fear sort of escalation into that kind of destruction, which would be very frightening indeed.
Okay. Final question is, of course, there's a hot war, but there's also a cold war, it seems, between Ankara and Moscow now. The Bloomberg article by Mark Champion points out to that. The headline of the article is Erdogan now testing the patience of Putin by growing involvement and pro-war engagement in the region. Is it happening? I mean, is
Yeah,
Erdogan
no,
really
I mean,
testing Putin's nerves now?
certainly. I mean, obviously, Putin and Erdogan used to have a kind of fairly good relationship of kind of mutual respect. I recall Erdogan visiting Moscow after the 2008 Russia-Georgia war. So I think it certainly to intervene into a traditional Russian region of influence like the Caucasus in this way is certainly to deeply anger Moscow, to clash in Libya by proxy is one thing, but to meet Russia and intervene directly in the Caucasus is another. So we certainly this is the beginning of a new story between Russia and Turkey, a very antagonistic story, and Russia will certainly be looking of ways to retaliate for that.
It has leverage.
It has leverage in many places, yeah.
So we are facing up to a growing, rising Cold War between two capitals,
Yeah,
possibly as if the positions do not change.
or we're back to the 19th century when Russia and Turkey would seem to fight a war with one another every 5 years, but we hope not. But
Tom DeWall, a top expert on South Caucasus and conflict of Nagorno-Karabakh, and the author of the book Black Garden. Thank you for this conversation, Tom.
thank you, Yavuz.
You can follow Ahval News online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here, for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.